What OHS Insider members need to know for July 2026. Hello and welcome to your July 2026 OHS Insider member briefing. This month, the big theme is preparation. Not just having policies on paper, but making sure your safety systems are ready for the real conditions your workers are facing right now. July brings a very specific set of risks for Canadian employers. Heat exposure increases. Seasonal workers enter the workplace. Remote, mobile, and client-site work can make incident reporting harder. Wildfire and evacuation planning becomes more urgent. And across the country, regulators, courts, and workers' compensation boards continue to raise expectations around training, documentation, supervision, and due diligence. So here is what OHS leaders, HR teams, supervisors, and senior management need to know this month. The first issue is heat awareness. Even in Canada, summer heat can create serious workplace risk. The concern is not limited to construction, forestry, agriculture, roadwork, or utilities. Those are obvious high-risk sectors because workers are outside doing physical labor, often while wearing PPE that traps heat. But heat risk can also show up in warehouses, manufacturing plants, commercial kitchens, delivery routes, vehicles, and offices without adequate climate control. The danger with heat stress is that it can escalate quickly. What begins as fatigue, cramping, dizziness, headache, nausea, or confusion can turn into heat exhaustion or heat stroke. And heat stroke is a medical emergency. The practical takeaway for employers is this: heat safety has to be planned before the hot day arrives. That means reviewing your heat stress policy, training workers and supervisors on early warning signs, making cool drinking water available, scheduling rest breaks in shaded or air-conditioned areas, using acclimatization protocols for new or returning workers, and adjusting workloads when conditions become dangerous. It also means looking at PPE. PPE is necessary, but it can make heat worse. Hard hats, gloves, high-visibility clothing, protective coveralls, and respiratory protection can reduce the body's ability to cool itself. Employers should consider lighter, breathable, moisture-wicking materials where appropriate, as well as cooling vests, neck wraps, ventilated hard hats, fans, misting systems, and task rotation. The key question for July is not, do we have a heat policy? The question is, would our supervisors and workers know exactly what to do if someone started showing symptoms today? The second issue is seasonal workers. Many employers rely on seasonal workers to manage summer workloads, vacations, peak operations, outdoor work, tourism, agriculture, construction, landscaping, and temporary staffing needs. But seasonal does not mean informal. Seasonal workers are still employees, and they are generally entitled to the same basic workplace protections as permanent employees. That includes minimum wage, overtime where applicable, vacation pay, statutory holiday entitlements, payroll deductions, proper records, breaks and rest periods, safe working conditions, appropriate training, supervision, and PPE. One risk area is misclassification. Employers should be careful about treating seasonal workers as independent contractors if the actual working relationship looks like employment. Another risk area is unclear expectations. If the duration of employment, schedule, duties, compensation, and end-of-season arrangements are not clearly defined, disputes can arise quickly. For OHS purposes, the most important point is that short-term workers still need proper safety onboarding. They need to know the hazards of the job, the reporting process, emergency procedures, PPE requirements, who supervises them, and what they are expected to do if they see unsafe work. The July action item is simple. Review your seasonal worker onboarding process. Make sure it is not just a payroll form and a quick tour. It needs to include safety responsibilities, hazard reporting, emergency contacts, workplace rules, and site-specific training. The third issue is environmental contamination and disclosure. This month's newsletter looks at a practical legal question. When land is contaminated, does a seller have to disclose that contamination to a buyer? The answer depends on whether the defect is considered patent or latent. A patent defect is something the buyer could reasonably discover through proper inspection or due diligence. A latent defect is something the buyer would not reasonably be expected to uncover, especially if the seller knows about it and actively conceals it. The broader lesson for OHS and environmental leaders is that environmental risk is not only an environmental issue. It can become a legal, financial, operational, and reputational issue. If your organization buys, leases, sells, develops, or repurposes property, environmental due diligence matters. That includes reviewing prior use, industrial history, environmental site assessments, soil testing, contract representations, hazardous substances, and any known contamination concerns. The July takeaway is this: do not assume that environmental risk is obvious, and do not assume that silence protects the organization. Whether you are the buyer, seller, tenant, landlord, developer, or contractor, documentation and due diligence are critical. The fourth issue is incident reporting for distributed workers. This is one of the most important operational topics in the July issue because many employers now have workers who are remote, mobile, working alone, traveling, driving, or located at client sites. Distributed work creates reporting gaps. A worker may be alone when something happens. The supervisor may be in another city. Witnesses may work for another employer. The first report may come by text message. Photos may disappear. Equipment may be moved. The client may start its own process. And the employer may still have legal reporting obligations in a specific jurisdiction. That is why incident reporting for remote and field workers has to be designed before an incident occurs. Workers need to know what must be reported. That includes injuries, illnesses, near misses, threats or violence, vehicle incidents, unsafe client-site conditions, equipment failures, environmental exposures, ergonomic issues, property damage, missed check-ins, and any event with serious potential. Supervisors need to know what must be escalated immediately. Serious events should not sit in an online form waiting for review. Vehicle crashes, violence, chemical exposures, hazardous energy events, serious near misses, unsafe client sites, and high potential incidents need a faster path. Safety staff need a jurisdictional reporting matrix. If workers operate across provinces, territories, or federally regulated work sites, the organization should know which regulator applies, what has to be reported, who reports it, what the timeline is, and what records must be kept. Client-site work also needs clarity. Reporting something to the client does not replace internal reporting. Employers should decide in advance who calls emergency services, who secures the scene, who notifies regulators, who investigates, and how evidence will be preserved. The July action item is to test your reporting process from the worker's point of view. If a mobile worker is injured at a client site at 4:30 p.m. on a Friday, do they know who to call, what to document, what to photograph, what not to disturb, and what happens next? The fifth issue is fire and evacuation planning. Emergency Preparedness Week took place in May, but July is when many organizations need to be especially alert to fire, smoke, heat, and wildfire-related disruptions. Wildfire seasons are becoming longer and more severe, while structural fires remain a persistent workplace hazard in offices, warehouses, manufacturing sites, healthcare settings, construction sites, kitchens, and industrial operations. A defensible fire and evacuation plan starts with a hazard assessment. Employers should identify ignition sources, fuel loads, electrical risks, flammable materials, hot work, poor housekeeping, nearby forests or grasslands, and any external wildfire exposure. Then the plan needs to be practical. Evacuation maps should be current. Routes and exits should reflect the actual layout of the workplace. Fire wardens or floor monitors should be trained. Headcount procedures should be clear. Communication systems should work for the workplace, whether that means alarms, public address systems, mobile notifications, radios, or satellite devices in remote environments. The weak point in many emergency plans is not the written document. It is execution. People do not always know where to go, who is responsible, what to do if an exit is blocked, how to respond to smoke conditions, or how to communicate during a fast-moving emergency. The July action item is to review your fire and evacuation plan and run a realistic drill, not just a checkbox drill. Consider scenario-based exercises, blocked exits, simulated smoke conditions, wildfire alerts, remote work contingencies, transportation logistics, and business continuity planning. Now, let's turn to the July month in review. At the federal level, Labour ministers have agreed to harmonise OHS curricula for working at heights and mobile elevating work platforms training by January 1st. The purpose is to make it easier for construction workers to move between jurisdictions without having to repeat safety training each time. Ministers are also expected to continue discussions around harmonizing hoisting and trenching training. For employers in construction and related sectors, this is worth watching. Harmonization could eventually simplify training portability, but it may also require employers to review whether their current programs align with the new expectations. In Alberta, Bill 31 proposes moving the province to permanent, year-round Mountain Daylight Time. While this is not a traditional OHS law, time changes can affect scheduling, fatigue, shift work, transportation, and seasonal operations. Employers should monitor the change and consider any operational impacts if the legislation passes. In British Columbia, the newsletter reports that there were 138 work fatalities in 2025. That includes 79 occupational disease deaths, 36 of which were due to asbestos exposure. 41 workers died from traumatic workplace injuries involving hazards such as falls from heights, being struck by objects, and being caught in machinery. Another 18 workers died in motor vehicle incidents. The message for BC employers is clear. Traditional serious hazards remain very real. Asbestos, falls, struck by hazards, machinery, and vehicle incidents continue to drive fatalities. These are not legacy issues. They remain active risk areas that require inspection, training, controls, supervision, and enforcement. In Manitoba, Bill 18 would authorize environmental officers to issue compliance orders for Waste Reduction and Prevention Act violations. Companies that fail to take the measures required in an order could face administrative monetary penalties. The bill also creates restrictions on knowingly providing false or misleading information to environmental officers or in required reports. For employers, this reinforces the need for accurate environmental records, truthful reporting, and timely corrective action when orders are issued. In New Brunswick, WorkSafe NB has adopted the electronic workers' application for compensation benefits and employer's report of injury or illness, known as E67, as the preferred method for workers and employers to submit injury and illness information electronically. The takeaway is that electronic reporting is becoming the expected process. Employers should make sure supervisors and payroll or claims staff know how to use the system and understand internal timelines for reporting injuries and illnesses. In Newfoundland and Labrador, Workplace NL's 2026 to 2028 strategic plan includes implementation of the revised Path 2 of the Prime program. Path 2 applies to larger employers who will need to implement a 15-element OHS best practices program to qualify for Prime refunds. For larger employers in the province, this creates a direct financial reason to strengthen OHS management systems. The stronger your program, the better positioned you may be for workers' compensation incentives. In the Northwest Territories, the government has announced plans to follow British Columbia and Alberta in ending seasonal time changes and adopting permanent year-round daylight saving time. Details are expected later this year. Again, employers should watch for scheduling and fatigue implications, especially in industries with shift work, transportation, emergency response, or remote operations. In Nova Scotia, 20 pollutants have been added to emissions limitations under the air quality regulations, effective June 1st. The list includes substances such as ammonia, arsenic, benzene, carbon monoxide, formaldehyde, lead, mercury, nitrogen dioxide, particulate matter, sulfur dioxide, and others. Organizations with air emissions should review whether the new limits affect their operations, permits, monitoring, reporting, maintenance practices, or engineering controls. In Nunavut, the WSCC has revised the formula used to annually adjust pensions and other workers' compensation payments and benefits for inflation. Employers should monitor how this may affect claims costs and compensation administration. In Ontario, Bill 105 proposes to increase workers' compensation loss of earnings benefits from 85% to 90% of a worker's take-home pay. It would also allow workers who continue working past age 65 to continue receiving LOE benefits, instead of forfeiting them under the current rules. If passed, this could affect claims costs, return to work planning, and workers' compensation exposure for Ontario employers. In Prince Edward Island, Bill 106 would prohibit employers from requiring employees to provide a medical certificate to verify eligibility for sick leave under the Employment Standards Act. If this passes, PEI employers will need to review sick leave policies, attendance management practices, and supervisor training to make sure they are not requesting documentation that is no longer permitted. In Quebec, applications for programs leading to 5 high-demand construction trades increased by 80% between January and March 2026. More than 7,600 people applied for carpenter, electrician, lineman, plumber, and refrigeration technician programs. For employers, this is a workforce signal. More entrants may be coming into high-risk trades, which makes onboarding, apprenticeship supervision, hazard training, and competency verification especially important. In Saskatchewan, the time loss injury rate reached an all-time low for the third year in a row, falling to 1.66 per 100 workers in 2025. Total injury rates also declined, although total accepted injury claims increased slightly. That is encouraging, but the goal should not be complacency. Lower rates are good, but employers still need to look at serious injury potential, leading indicators, near misses, and whether incidents are being reported consistently. In Yukon, the 2025 time loss injury rate fell to a decade low of 1.2 per 100 workers. Claims filed and claims accepted both decreased. However, there were 4 work fatalities in 2025, 2 more than in 2024. That is an important reminder that injury rates alone do not tell the whole story. A workplace can have fewer claims and still face serious or fatal incidents. Employers should track both frequency and severity. Finally, the July case alerts give members several practical lessons. A federal court confirmed that a personal objection to vaccination is not automatically protected as religion. Employers dealing with vaccine refusals still need to proceed carefully, but the case reinforces the difference between personal belief and protected religious belief. An Alberta OHS case involving asbestos records shows that confidentiality is not the same thing as privilege. A consulting firm was penalized for refusing to provide records requested by OHS inspectors, although the appeal board reduced the penalty. The lesson is that employers and consultants need to understand what information is truly privileged, what must be disclosed, and how to manage sensitive safety records. A BC excavation contractor was fined $460,000 after a trench collapse killed one worker and seriously injured another. The case involved C-45 criminal negligence and is a powerful reminder that trenching and excavation hazards can create not only regulatory liability, but criminal liability where those in control of work fail to take reasonable steps to prevent harm. A petroleum refiner was fined more than $182,000 after a hot oil incident involving a heavy fuel oil line. The cited failures included safe work procedures, hazard assessment, hot work permitting, standby person requirements, and PPE. The lesson is direct. High hazard work needs formal controls before the job starts. A Manitoba government agency was fined $100,000 after a wildfire worker died in an ATV rollover. The case highlights training, safe work procedures, compliance, and proper head protection for powered mobile equipment. And a workplace harassment complaint involving a brewery worker was dismissed because the evidence did not support the claim that closing duties were assigned based on sex. The broader point is that employers need consistent job duties, clear checklists, documented expectations, and a proactive system for identifying and responding to harassment concerns. So what should members do this month? First, review your heat stress program before the next heat wave. Second, tighten your seasonal worker onboarding and make sure temporary workers receive real safety training. Third, review incident reporting for remote, mobile, and client-site workers. Fourth, update your fire and evacuation plan and run a practical drill. Fifth, review your jurisdictional compliance obligations from the month in review, especially if you operate in more than one province or territory. And sixth, use this month's case alerts as a due diligence checklist. Ask whether your organization can prove effective training, hazard assessment, supervision, documentation, emergency planning, and follow-up. That is the core message for July. Summer does not create new safety responsibilities, but it does expose weak systems. The employers that are best protected are the ones that do not wait for the incident, the heat wave, the inspection, the wildfire alert, or the claim to find out whether their program works. For more details, members can read the full July 2026 OHS Insider newsletter and the complete month in review on ohsinsider.com.